Good morning, everyone. I'm Blazer, final year PhD student at Carnegie Mellon, and I'll be talking about our group's work on modeling password strength. So in the course of doing passwords research, we often come across a very important question. That is, how strong is a particular password? Sometimes it's actually really easy to know the answer. For instance, the password I love you, we know this is one of the 20 most common passwords, so we know that's bad. On the other end of the spectrum, sometimes we see a password and assuming it's actually random, we know it's good. Most commonly, however, we're somewhere in the middle. We need to gauge password strength for passwords like these, human-chosen things. So why is this important? Well, accurately measuring password strength lets us do a number of things. First, it helps us eliminate bad passwords. For instance, in organizational password audits, we can pinpoint which are the bad passwords and make sure that they're changed. It also helps us help users make better passwords. So for instance, in the course of doing research, if we come up with some novel intervention, let's say some way of having people make passwords in multiple steps, we can determine if these interventions we're testing are actually effective, as long as we can measure password strength effectively and accurately. And also provide users feedback as they're making a password about whether the password is good or not. So traditionally, people have used statistical approaches. In ancient history, it was Shannon entropy, the information theoretic approach. More recently, alpha guesswork and other approaches have fixed some of the problems of Shannon entropy. These are really cool results. However, in the types of research we often do, they don't quite apply. They don't provide per password strength estimates. And they also require pretty huge samples. So for instance, if you have the email passwords for a major email provider, you can do these kinds of analyses. If you have a couple hundred participants in a study, you can't do these analyses. So as a result of this, a lot of researchers have been using parameterized guessability to measure password strength. That is, how many guesses would a particular cracking algorithm with particular training data take to guess a password? So in essence, what you're doing here is running a password cracking approach, counting guesses, and anytime something that's in your target set is guessed, you note down what its guess number is. So that is to say, for each password, you have a guess number. So for instance, it might be 366 billion is the guess number for that password. Of course, you can only run this attack for a finite amount of time, and so at some point you stop. Right? And anything that's passed that hasn't been guessed yet, you say, well, the guess number is past the cutoff. And you don't know if it's one past the cutoff or many, many, many orders of magnitude past the cutoff. But implicitly you're saying, well, if it's past the cutoff, this is a pretty good password. It's pretty strong. Right? And so throughout this talk, I'll be plotting guessability for different password sets. So I just want to walk through what these plots look like. So in this kind of a guessability plot, on the x-axis, we have the number of guesses in logarithmic scale. And on the y-axis, you have the percentage of passwords that are guessed at that point. And you might notice that nowhere in this plot is wall clock time. And that's because the wall clock time that this corresponds to depends heavily on two major factors. First, the hashing algorithm that's used to store the password. And second, your assumptions about the resources that the attacker has that you want to model. And so this makes a big difference. So for instance, for some hash functions, a million guesses is a lot. For other hash functions, 10 to the 15 guesses is just getting started. Right. So guessability has a number of advantages, which is why it's been taken up by a number of researchers. It's straightforward to think about. It models an actual attack. It provides per password strength estimates. Now we have to consider what guessability looks like in practice. If we think about the broader password cracking ecosystem, there are some really experienced password crackers in the world. For instance, working at computer forensics firms, people who've, for years, their whole job has been cracking passwords, and they've gotten pretty good at this. There's also a large password cracking community. Right? But as we use guessability in our research papers, well, in practice, it's really just grad students doing their best. Right? So it's password cracking experience will be, for instance, doing guessability analysis for a research paper. And this raises a number of questions, the answers to which will help us understand how repeatable and how accurate and how much should we trust the results in the research literature. So for one thing, grad students are not experienced password crackers. Would an experienced professional provide different security results for a particular analysis? Second, out of necessity and resources and time, most research papers using guessability just take one single cracking approach and run with it. Right? And this is rational, but there are many cracking approaches. would you get a different result if you substituted in a different cracking approach? Similarly, you know, when you're starting as a grad student to crack passwords for the purpose of calculating guessability, well, you use the default configuration, which again is a quite rational choice, but there are a lot of other more advanced configurations. Would those actually impact your research results if you use those instead? Right. So just to reiterate these questions, we're curious, first, how does guessability used in research compare to an attack by professionals? And second, would substituting another cracking approach impact research results? And answering these questions helps us understand how much we should trust the research literature on passwords, all the papers that use guessability. And in this work, we answer these questions. And to do so, we calculate the guessability for each password in four different sets of passwords with five different password cracking approaches, each of which in numerous configurations. Right? And so first, I'd like to walk through these different password sets and these different password cracking approaches. So our four password sets differed by the password composition policy under which passwords were created. First, we have the basic passwords, which require only eight or more characters in the password, no further requirements. We have the complex passwords, which again require eight characters, but now also require that all four character classes, uppercase and lowercase letters, digits, and symbols, be used. And for long basic passwords, which require 16 or more characters, and our long complex passwords, which require at least 12 characters from at least three different character classes. And all these password sets are things we collected for our prior research studies on passwords. So now I'd like to walk you through the five different cracking approaches we evaluated. Two of these are software tools, two of these are probabilistic models used frequently in academia, and the fifth is an attack by professionals. So first, John the Ripper. It's a widely known software tool that's been used both password cracking community, but also in a number of research papers as a part of calculating password guessability. And the conceptual model of John the Ripper is that it guesses variants of an input word list. So basically, you give it a word list, which are passwords and dictionary entries, and you give it a set of mangling rules. Right? And from this, it calculates or it computes potential candidate password guesses. Right? And it does so quite quickly. And using John the Ripper, we ran 10 to the 13 guesses for our basic passwords. Throughout the rest of the talk and on the graphs, I'll label John the Ripper JTR. So let me just run through a toy example of how this works. So you take your input word list, for instance, Usenix and security, and some set of mangling rules. And what John the Ripper does is it takes the first mangling rule, in this case, say, do nothing to the word list entries, and it runs the whole word list through that mangling rule. Then it goes to the second word list entry, for instance, add one at the end, and runs the whole word list through that, so on and so forth. Right? Okay. Our second model, Hashcat, is also a software tool, also used quite widely in password cracking and in research. And what has the same Hashcat has the same conceptual model as John the Ripper. Again, requires a word list and mangling rules. Again, computes, cracks passwords quite quickly. Again, we ran 10 to the 13 guesses for our basic passwords. Hashcat does have a number of key differences, however. Let me point out one. So if we use the same toy example, Hashcat actually enumerates guesses in a very different order. So whereas John the Ripper started with the first mangling rule and ran the whole word list through it, Hashcat actually starts with the first word list entry and runs that through all of the different mangling rules. Right? So in this instance, it mangles Usenix in many different ways, mangle security in a lot of different ways. So what that means is that for John the Ripper, it's crucial that your mangling rules be in a very good order. For Hashcat, it's crucial that your word list be in a very good order. Okay. Next, I'd like to speak briefly about the probabilistic approaches. So the Markov model assigns probabilities to subsequent characters based on the previous ones. And it requires weighted training data, that is, passwords, dictionaries. And conveniently, a model at Oakland last year did a comprehensive evaluation of different configurations of Markov models, and we actually employ what they found was best for the types of passwords we study. However, the speed of this approach is quite slow. Theoretically, it requires a lot of state, and this contributes to the slowness, and it's also research quality code. And so both these things together mean that it actually takes quite a while to generate guesses. So in our tests, we were able to generate 10 to the 10 guesses, and actually more time than it would have taken for us to generate 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 16 Hashcat guesses. Okay. Fourth approach is probabilistic context-free grammar, which basically generates a grammar of passwords based on the probabilities of password structures and the probability of the things you fill into those structures. This is an approach that was proposed by Weir et al. At Oakland in 2009, in which our group's been working on quite a bit since then, including an Oakland 2012 paper. Right. And so just like Markov, it requires a lot of state, again, research quality code, so it takes a while. However, as part of our group's work on it, we've transformed it into creating a lookup table instead. So rather than enumerating guesses, we can rely on the fact that many passwords have the same probability and just look up what the guess number would be. So we can go a little bit faster based on that. And so using this, we generate 10 to the 14 guesses. And throughout the talk, I'll refer to this as PCFG, probabilistic context-free grammar. Right. So then fifth approach is the professionals, right? And so this was the big open question. Well, how different is a professional attack from what a grad student could get in the lab? Right? So to evaluate this, we contracted CoreLogic, which is a computer forensics and penetration testing firm that has a large business in password auditing for Fortune 500 companies. And they're also well known in the password cracking community for running the DEF CON Crack Me If You Can password cracking contest. And so we contracted CoreLogic, and we said, throw everything you've got at these passwords. So they used their proprietary word lists and configurations, and we had them make 10 of the 14 guesses. So in addition to using their proprietary word lists and configurations, another important aspect of a professional attack is the manual component. That is, they manually tune their attack to things they expect to see in the password set right at the beginning. And then as the cracking is going along, they're keeping track of what passwords have already been cracked. And if any unexpected patterns seem to be popping out of these cracked passwords, they actually update their attack as they're going along. And so we had them do this. So I've just walked you through our four different password sets and five different approaches. Now I'd like to take you through some highlights of our results. And I'll do this in three parts. First, I want to note the importance of configuration when calculating password guessability. Second, I'll compare the approaches for two of the password sets. And third, I'll evaluate the impact on research analyses if you use one approach in place of another. So first result, we found configuration is absolutely critical in evaluating password guessability. So this graph shows the attacking long complex passwords with a number of different configurations of Hashcat. So the one that's up there already is the best 64 set of mangling rules for Hashcat, which is as close to a default configuration as there is. You see, it starts guessing passwords, makes a bit over a billion guesses, and at that point has guessed about 3% of the long complex passwords. So that is 97% of the passwords in our long complex set are past the guess cutoff, and implicitly we're assuming, hey, these seem pretty strong. Right? However, if you actually try more advanced configurations, you would come to a bit of a different conclusion. So for instance, if you use another rule set that comes with Hashcat, it cracks almost 20% of the passwords, albeit in more guesses. We tried a number of other things. We tried some rules we translated from John the Ripper. We tried rules donated to us by an InfoSec professional who also does a lot of password cracking. And then we also tried another set of bigger word lists. Right? And so you see, basically, depending on the configuration, you'll get a very, very different idea of what it means for the guessability of a password set by Hashcat. Right? And so, yeah, whether 97% of your passwords are past the guess cutoff or 55% are past the cutoff, makes a big difference for your research analyses. Next, I'd like to walk through a comparison of approaches. First, I'll do this for the basic passwords. Right, and so here we have the basic passwords, and we'll start with Markov, which in its 10 billion guesses, 10 to the 10, guessed over 50% of the passwords. And now let's start pulling in the other approaches. So if we pull in the probabilistic context-free grammar, see, it follows actually a quite similar trajectory and keeps going. Right, now I'll pull in John the Ripper, and Hashcat. And you'll see one of the more notable things here is at a very, very high level view, particularly asymptotically, these actually all perform pretty well as long as they're well configured. That's particularly notable since there's a lot of research literature on approach X is way better than approach Y, approach Y is way better than approach Z. And we found that, well, as long as you're configuring them relatively effectively, they all do pretty well. Of course, as we'll discuss later, each password cracking approach is a little bit better than others, or in some cases, a lot better than others, on cracking certain types of passwords. So we said, well, let's be a little bit more conservative here. Let's effectively run all four of these approaches in parallel and say, well, whichever approach gets to a password first and guesses it, we'll say that's the guess number for the password. So it's the quickest it was guessed by any approach. And we call this the min auto curve, which I'm showing in the dotted line. Right? And so you'll see that within 10 to the 14 guesses, we're already guessing approximately 85% of the passwords in our basic set. So because essentially these set it and forget it approaches used by grad students can already get 85% of these passwords, we didn't bother sending it to the pros. These passwords can already be cracked. So next, I'll show you our complex passwords. So again, so we start with Markov, which doesn't actually generate that many guesses for this policy. I'll pull in the probabilistic context-free grammar. Let me pull in John the Ripper, Hashcat. And you'll see they diverge somewhat. Next, I'd like to bring in our min-auto curve. Right, so we bring in the min-auto. And now I'd like to bring in the pros. So the here are the professionals in the dark black line. So what you see is that the min-auto approach is actually a pretty conservative estimate of how the pros do. So just to make this clearer, let me remove the other lines. Right? So we see, you know, basically, grad students, if they're using all these approaches in parallel and configuring these tools effectively, can be a pretty conservative proxy for the pros. And we found similar results for the other password sets we examined. Right. Finally, I'd like to go through the impact of the way you configure guessability and the way you run your guessability results on research analyses. Right? And so we asked three different types of questions and said, well, for each of these three types of questions, if you use one password cracking approach as your guessability metric, and you instead use a different one, would that change your results? And so we first looked at coarse-grained analyses. These are questions like, how guessable relatively are 8-character and 12-character and 16-character passwords? And what we found is that no matter what approach you used, you know, whether it was Hashcat, Markov, pros, min-auto, combining all of them, you got basically the same results in all of them. So this is good news. That means we don't have to throw out our research literature on passwords. Right? Then we looked at more fine-grained analyses, and this is a direction that password research community is going in. So asking questions like, for instance, how do character substitutions impact password guessability? How good or bad are all-digit passwords? And here we found actually quite different results depending on the password cracking approach you use to calculate guessability. Right. Finally, we said, well, what happens when you analyze just a single password? Would swapping out a different cracking approach make a big difference? And yes, it did. And I'd like to just show you two quick examples of this. So for instance, let's say we wanted to calculate the guessability of this password, for instance, in an institutional password audit or as part of a password feedback tool for users. Right? So we look at this and we say, well, this looks pretty predictable. And John the Ripper agrees. This was guess number 801 for John the Ripper. Right? And so this is basically saying, hey, you know, even if you have a rate-limited situation, let's say in an online attack, this password is probably still going to be vulnerable. Right? However, now let's ask probabilistic context-free grammar about this password. Here, in the 10 to the 14 guesses PCFG made, it wasn't guessed, right? And this actually, when you start take a step back and think about it, makes sense. The probabilistic context-free grammar is context-free, assuming essentially whenever there's a change in character class, these are independent parts of the password. But this password is actually quite context-dependent. So this result makes sense, but if you're just blindly saying, let's use this as our guessability metric, you'll get a wrong answer. Now let's look at the opposite scenario. So for this password, again, looks pretty predictable. The probabilistic context-free grammar says, yeah, it's fairly predictable. That's guess number 130,555. For these long basic passwords, we made 10 to the 10 John the Ripper guesses, and this wasn't guessed by John the Ripper. So again, we see really large divergence in what the conclusion you would come to if you're analyzing the strength of a single password using just a single password cracking approach. So just to run through some of our conclusions, we found that, in general, running a single approach is insufficient for most of the types of interesting password analyses we'd like to do. And this is really especially true out of the box. If you're just running the default configuration of a password cracking tool, which is what happens most of the time in the research literature, in many cases, you vastly underestimate the vulnerability of a password set to a password cracking attack. We also found that min-auto, running all these approaches in parallel, was a pretty conservative proxy for the pros. We examined the impact on different types of analyses. We found that with coarse-grained analyses, we found generally the same results if you switch out and swapped in a different password cracking approach. However, for more targeted fine-grained analyses, things like impact of character substitutions or particular types of passwords, for instance, all-digit passwords, we found different answers depending on the approach you used. We also found that the analysis of a single password, you would often get quite different answers depending on the password cracking approach you used. Right? So taking all of this together, we said, you know, well, wouldn't it be nice if the password research community had a little bit more systemization in the way it did guessability analyses? Like, wouldn't it be great if everyone who wrote a passwords research paper could have all these same kinds of analyses we did, and actually didn't have to spend that much time doing that? Right? So that would help the scientific rigor of passwords research make it more comparable. And so we decided to put our money where our mouth is, or I guess perhaps more accurately, our machines where our mouth is. And today we've launched the Password Guessability Service, pgs.ece.cmu.edu, which is a service for the research community. I mean, what this does is it enables other researchers to submit their plain text passwords. So you send us your plain text passwords, you select which password cracking approaches, or all of them, that you'd like us to run guessability analyses for. And then in a matter of hours or days or sometimes as long as a couple weeks, depending on the approaches you choose, you get back PGP encrypted email with the guess numbers for these passwords under that approach. All right. And so, you know, because we really want to see more systemization, more reproducibility in the passwords research literature, we've decided to offer this free to the research community in hopes of spurring this kind of adoption. So I hope all of you who do passwords research end up using our service, and we're happy to work with you and configure it however would best suit your needs, within reason. And so, yeah, I'd like to now open it up to questions about all this stuff. Stuart?
Hi, quick methodological question.
Yes.
Did you count it as a guess if along the path of generated passwords there was one that did not meet the policy?
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, in case you didn't hear, Stuart's question was it counted as a guess if a candidate guess did not meet the password composition policy? And so for the probabilistic context-free grammar, Markov and John the Ripper, no, we did not count it as a guess if it did not meet the password composition policy. However, for a Hashcat, which is closed source, it doesn't support doing that. And this is actually rational because the cost for fast hashes, the cost of actually eliminating guesses and just waiting is actually greater than the cost of just hashing this, it turns out to be invalid guess. And so it's basically the realistic behavior of a closed source tool is what it is for Hashcat, which is why you actually see on a bunch of the graphs, it looks like Hashcat is lagging. And you might wonder, well, then why are in these password cracking contests is Team Hashcat coming out ahead often? And that's why.
So you talked about basically grad students versus pros being better or worse at doing password cracking. Mm-hmm. There's also the question of how much you adjust the cracking to different studies. So if you're trying to answer a question like, do English speakers, or is this set of passwords picked by English speakers stronger than this set of passwords picked by Russian speakers, mm-hmm. you need to, do the work to modify for both English and Russian. Do you think the pros do a better job, a much better job, a slightly better job, or, equivalent?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, essentially, where you would just have a different philosophy of attack against different sets. And so this is something where I think it really depends on how experienced that particular professional is at guessing the set. So, for instance, someone who grew up in Russia would probably be a lot better at attacking the Russian passwords. And so I think it really depends on the experience. So, for instance, like this out-of-the-box guessability, even using our password guessability service, wouldn't get you to the answer that you want for that particular type of analysis. And as an interesting side note, actually, this year's DEF CON Crack Me If You Can contest, which actually just happened last week. The focus of the contest was international password cracking and actually cracking UTF-8 passwords. So there's actually been some quite timely work in the password cracking community on that, but essentially coming up with a principled way of saying what's the equivalent attack for an English speaker and a Russian speaker, I think requires a lot more thought and isn't something you're going to get out of the box. Thanks.
As we know, the PCFG cracking and the micromode-based cracking, they all need some training data. So did you consider the impacts of you know, different training data on the final cracking performance?
Yeah, so that's this is something I didn't cover in the talk for both the probabilistic approaches, the Markov models and the probabilistic context-free grammar. We tried actually different types of tuning, and I think it's probably not of interest to everyone here, but I'm happy to talk in great depth offline about that. And we also have some of those results in the appendix of our paper.
Okay, another correlated question is when you evaluate the crackability of one single password, I'm also wondering is the NA difference if you use different training data to, you know, to train these models, then the crack, the guess number may be different. Thank you.
Right, yeah. So the training data is very, very important. And so we use the same training data across all of all four approaches that we set up. And so this consisted of a couple of major plain text password leaks, as well as a number of natural language dictionaries. And again, training data makes a huge difference. We took something that we and others had found works quite well. Of course, you know, there's still many open questions about what's the, perfect, precise, exact, best way to do it. That's actually likely an unanswerable question. Happy to talk more offline about that as well.
Thank you. Very nice talk. Why did you stop at 10 to the 13 or 10 to the 14 password guesses? As like you can hash 10 to the 12, 13 guesses on a regular cluster quite quickly.
Right. Yeah. So in each of these cases, we essentially ran each of the approaches to as far as we could in the confines of writing a research paper. And so basically for each of these approaches, this was on the order of weeks. And so then this raises the question of what is strong, what is weak when you're thinking of it. So for instance, for something like a fast hash, like a NTLM or MD5, as you said, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 is nothing. We can for MD5, for instance, get 10 to the 15 guesses in hours just on a high-end graphics card. However, for hash functions like Bcrypt, Scrypt, those types of things, 10 to the 15, you're not going to get 10 to the 15. They use basically iterated hashes and also memory hard functions to make it intentionally slower, again, creating this arms race. And so it really, your interpretation of these plots is going to depend a lot on the attack model. But I think one of the big takeaways here is if you're running a site and you're worried about an offline attack and you're hashing passwords with MD5 or NTLM, your password set's toast. Like all of them are gone, basically. Yep.
Yeah, speaking of hashing with MD5, what about Rainbow Table's input on the password lists and the mangling for putting into a rainbow table of a certain character set? 8 characters, UTF-8, is pretty much a given in rainbow tables now. Mm-hmm. But what about the longer passwords? Do you have any insight into that?
Right, yeah. So, I guess this is probably also a question that would be better addressed offline. So, the idea of rainbow tables, pre-computing the outputs and what the pre-image of the hash would be, well, one thing you can do against that is salting the passwords, and then by the number of passwords, that's how much you're increasing the work to actually, you can't directly use a rainbow table in that case. I'm happy to discuss, this is more of a password ecosystem question, very happy to discuss this more offline. Yeah. Cool, great. Thanks
Let's thank Blaze again.